This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, December 6th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. Let's talk about customer ratings for a minute. We've been poking around customer reviews today. The Olive Garden restaurant in the middle of Times Square here in New York, Olive Garden's Yelp review, 3 out of 5 stars. That's 60%. Justice League in theaters now, made for the cool price of $600 million and widely panned. Polls on Rotten Tomatoes at 41%. And President Donald Trump, who has the worst approval rating of any modern president at this point in his term, hovering around 35%, according to the Gallup tracking poll. Well, you are the customer for the GOP tax plan winding its way through Congress now. Well, you and corporate America are the customers. And your customer rating for the GOP tax plan? 29. That's right, 29. Outpolled by Justice League, by Olive Garden, by the president himself. Gallup says that just 29% of Americans approve of the Senate tax plan. The Quinnipiac poll, same result, 29. But forward it goes on to conference negotiations with the House. President Trump, he's been posting customer ratings for the tax plan. Here he was on Tuesday.
The taxes we're so thrilled about, so popular, and I think something is going to be coming out of conference pretty quickly as opposed to long-term. I think it's going to go pretty quickly.
Well, will it go pretty quickly? That's the goal. There are some obstacles, though, and a couple of Republican senators who still have the power to give the ultimate bad review to this tax bill would not recommend. 0 stars. Richard Rubin, U.S. tax policy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Hi, Richard.
Hey there, Todd.
Great to have you back on, Richard. Look, the House and Senate have gotten to work now on final negotiations on a tax bill. How close are they, and are they going to produce something that the president's going to be able to give a 5-star rating to?
Well, they're making some progress. They've been talking even before the formal conference starts, which is pretty typical here in Congress. They've got a bunch of things that they do have to work out. So I try and think of it in three kinds of different ways. One is what you could think of as switches. So there's a bunch of things that were in one bill, not in the other. So like the House repeals the medical expense deduction, the Senate doesn't. It's an on-off switch. They can just pick like which one we do. Then there's like dials, right? And you could say, well, you know, the House sets the top tax rate at 39.6 for individuals. The Senate sets it at 38.5. We could, you know, they can meet in the middle. There's a whole bunch of numerical things where they could do that. And then there's sort of like swapping blueprints, right? And so there's things like how you tax pass-through businesses, which is this whole new complicated area of law they're writing, or international tax rules. And there you might see them pick one or the other as the starting point and then tweak it a little bit. So they've got a bunch of work to do because the two bills are different, but the architecture of them is the same. And so it's really just about, to use the seasonal joke, making a list and checking it twice and just kind of going down and seeing who exactly, you know, in each of those areas, what they've got the votes for.
Now, come on, Richard, you just mixed metaphors. You started with switches and dials. I was following you, and then you landed on Santa's list.
Well, you know, I'm it's been a long month, man.
Well, no, look, hey, it has been for us all. Trust me. Look, Richard, okay, switches and dials I get. There are a couple of potential hammers here, though, too, right? Because it was touch and go for a long time in the Senate, in the GOP Senate last week. The bill passed out after Mitch McConnell agreed to some demands from a couple senators like Susan Collins of Maine, Jeff Flake of Arizona, that they say have to be met when this bill comes out of final negotiations. Let's start with Susan Collins. What does she want?
Well, she's concerned about the repeal of the individual mandate to have health insurance, and she wants to make sure that what's known as Alexander Murray, a sort of bill to shore up individual insurance markets, comes along with it. She's been a little less than certain about whether that has to happen first before she'll vote for a final tax bill, but she's also been clear that she has not committed to vote for a final tax bill, in part because we don't have a final tax bill yet for her to look at. So her vote is open, but remember, even if she votes no, the Republicans still have 50 votes, so and would be able to pass this with Vice President Pence breaking the tie. So in some ways, they don't need her vote coming back. It obviously gives them some cushion in case anyone else gets a little nervous about where this bill's going.
Well, what about Jeff Flake of Arizona?
He had secured a promise to be part of discussions on immigration, and he had also got some changes to what's known as expensing, so writing off business investments. You know, we'll have to see. He's obviously been very, very critical of the president, but he's willing to vote for the bill. So and he hasn't necessarily put out that sort of, it has to have XYZ before I'll vote for it again. So, but here's the thing, though. One thing that has come out in the past couple of days, there's sort of this, tax law fan fiction out there that that the House might just pass the Senate bill, and you could sort of see that as plausible, right? That would make the Senate not have to vote again. But one thing the Senate did in its last minute rush, as we've been writing about in the Journal this week, is they repealed the corporate. They reinstated the corporate alternative minimum tax, which is something that almost nobody paid attention to, but they stuck it back in there at the last minute. And the way that they did it, and I can explain further if you want, but the way they did it basically undermined the research and development tax credit, fouled with their new international tax system, and caused a whole, messed up the municipal bond market if they do it. So the bill they've got would be a mess if they actually enacted it, according to every tax expert we talk to. So they're going to have to deal with that in conference, which means both the House and Senate would have to vote again.
Yeah, that's not fanfic. That's cold, hard reality. Look, Jeff Flake and his immigration asks has a lot to do with DACA, the Deferred Action Program in immigration. And we're going to be talking about that in just a minute, what Jeff Flake wants to see from a DACA fix and a growing number of Republicans, too. Whether it sinks a tax bill or not is another question. But Richard, before we let you go, here's another metaphor for your stack, wild card. What about the election in Alabama? What if Democrat Doug Jones were to win there and Republican Roy Moore didn't come to the Senate?
Well, this is a bit of a wild card. We don't know exactly how long it would take to seat someone from Alabama, so they would have a cushion of 8 to 10 to 12 days, maybe more. No pun intended, to get something voted on before the new senator is seated. And again, remember, if Collins is, you know, you have to sort of think about all the levers and potential votes here about how that works. So, yeah, that's a potential problem. And that's one of the things among just the general pressure that's pushing them to try and get something done as soon as possible.
Watching policy, watching demands from senators, watching the conference committee, even watching Alabama. With all of his metaphors in hand, Richard Rubin, tax policy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, man.
Yep.
Well, we just talked about Senator Jeff Flake's moves. He says are designed to help get a fix to the DACA program that's winding its way through Congress. You'll remember that back in September, President Trump announced he's rescinding deferred action for childhood arrivals, telling Congress, it's on you. Make a decision by March 5th of 2018. And that move left more than 800,000 DACA recipients in a kind of a limbo, unsure of what their status will be if Congress can't make a new law, and even if they might be targets for deportation. That has Democrats and a growing number of Republicans, in fact, working to get a deal before March and a leverage game starting behind the scenes on Capitol Hill. Adriana Gomez-Licon is Hispanic Affairs reporter for the AP. She's here to talk about Congress and about the families watching to see what will happen to them. Adriana, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, Todd.
Well, what has life been like for DACA recipients since the president's announcement in September that he was going to rescind this program?
Well, first of all, many of them only had 1 month to get documents together, money together, to send in their applications for renewal. So it's been kind of hectic for some of them. And then for the rest, it's been like, well, what may happen after March? Can I plan my life? Can I go on with my job? So it's been pretty uncertain. Right now, what the Department of Homeland Security is saying is that if you turn in your documents before October 5th, they will consider some applications, but they do need to show proof that they submitted them before the October 5th deadline. So no one is applying anymore right now.
October 5th is passed, so if you miss that window, people just are waiting and watching.
Exactly. They're waiting, basically watching Congress to see what they do.
Well, let's go inside Congress right now. Democrats are trying to up the pressure to pass some sort of DACA fix with, as I said, an increasing number of Republicans, Jeff Flake in the Senate, as we mentioned, and some House Republicans, too. What's the state of play?
Well, the Democrats have a lot of support. They think they have enough support to pass what they call the DREAM Act, which would actually include more people than just DACA recipients. And then we have at least a group of 34 House Republicans who are asking Paul Ryan to deal with this, to bring it up to vote at least and before the year ends.
Before the end of the year. And do you have a sense of what that policy might look like? Because we talk about a DACA fix, and there are lots of different forms that can take. There's the DREAM Act, as you mentioned, and it could be something weaker.
Right. There's another bill called Recognizing American Children Act. Some Republicans are saying that there will be a merge of both of them. But they're still in discussion, and we don't know what it's going to look like. I mean, of course, what dreamers are hoping for is that it's like a permanent status. Basically, they can live here, they can work here. They no longer have this sort of stave off of their deportation. They're just here as permanent residents.
Adriana, what kind of pressure is on Paul Ryan, though, in the House? I mean, it's very possible, I suppose, to have a grand coalition of Democrats and, as you said, 30, 40, 45 Republicans who want a fix. I don't think Paul Ryan's conservative base and the Freedom Caucus want a fix at all. They don't want this fix, and they might be putting enormous pressure on him to back away here.
They do. I mean, they are putting some pressure on Paul Ryan. There was the news last week of Congressman Carlos Curbelo saying that he won't approve any spending bill that funds the government after the year ends if DACA is not approved but not even taken into consideration. But Paul Ryan has actually said, why do we make a December deadline when the deadline is March? That's the deadline President Donald Trump gave in September when he rescinded DACA. So he's saying that December deadline is just artificial. We're making it up. This is not our priority right now.
So that means, Adriana, that all of the DACA recipients and their families, 800,000 people or more, might be watching a government shutdown fight or something like it at the end of the month, not worried just about a shutdown, but whether or not they're going to be able to stay in the country.
Well, yeah, the discussions of the shutdown are, there's a lot of different ways in which it could go. They could still fund it to December 22nd, or now they're talking December 30th. So we don't know exactly what that's going to look like. But for these dreamers, I mean, I have talked to dreamers who are actually going to lose status in December, and they were not able to renew it because they didn't meet the October 5th deadline. And they're really just really hoping for a December fix. And likely what it's looking right now is that it's still not going to be considered, according to what Paul Ryan has said.
Adriana, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Todd.
Adriana Gomez-Licon, Hispanic Affairs reporter for the AP. All this week, we're looking at the future of the Republican Party and its many factions, from the Never Trumpers to the Chamber of Commerce establishment types, hi Paul Ryan, to the anti-establishment populist wing of the party, making America great again. Today, we continue with a former leader of the GOP, Michael Steele, former chairman of the Republican National Committee from 2009 until 2011. Michael Steele, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, Todd. It's good to be with you, man.
It's good to have you, too. Michael Steele, what does the Republican Party look like to you now as you survey it?
It's a hot mess. It's what it is right now, I have to be honest. You aptly described the various factions that have emerged or reemerged within the party. And this goes back a number of years now. There's been an underlying tension that has not been dealt with for quite a while, I would say probably since Reagan left, where the brand of conservatism that Reagan established began to slip, slide, morph, change as the party really was looking for the next wave of leaders and leadership that would continue what Reagan had begun. And I think you've seen some of that boil up, certainly in the 16 election. The president, as a candidate, took advantage of that, had his finger on the pulse, and was able to best 15 of the, quote, establishment players, from governors to U.S. senators to businessmen and women, in a way that really pointed out just how factionalized the party is at its core.
So if that fight was smoldering all the way back to Reagan in your party, as you say, The election of Barack Obama really threw gasoline on it, Michael Steele. Yes. There's no question about it. Now, you ran the RNC during the rise of the Tea Party. What was your role, do you think, through embracing the Tea Party and co-opting it into the GOP base in helping giving you know, rise to Trumpist populism today?
Well, that you know, I didn't even, well, in one sense, didn't see it becoming Trumpism because there was no expectation of a Trump-like person. But speaking directly to the Tea Party, the key thing to recognize with Tea Party in its early formation was it's the energy behind it. What was animating these individuals to go out to town hall meetings, to begin to, you know, raise their voice and take action against incumbent Republicans and against the party and the system as a whole? And it had to do with broken promises, lies, expectations, a number of things that the establishment leadership had over a generation since Reagan made promises from, on healthcare to abortion to family values, all these issues that had been used to whipsaw this base back and forth.
And Michael Steele, during this time, you know, you were also one of the people shouting for the GOP to widen its appeal, find policies and messages that would appeal to more than just suburban and rural whites. The party has gone in exactly the opposite direction.
Yeah.
It's embraced various shades of white ethno-nationalism. Where is all this headed?
Well, it's headed to a not a very good place, because I think what you're going to see with the elevation of Roy Moore, which I suspect likely will happen next Tuesday in Alabama, the flip by the National Party and backing and supporting him, and certainly the president himself endorsing him, is going to be the ultimate turnoff for a very core constituency, one that is outcome determinative when it comes to voting across the country, and that's the female vote. I think there's a misunderstanding of what white women, particularly educated white women, did in 2016 in backing Donald Trump. It was less about Donald Trump and more about how they viewed Hillary Clinton. And I think a misinterpretation of that seems to lead people to believe that they can pretty much say and do anything and these women will be there for them. I think this is now a very bright line for them, and it's going to be a real challenge for the party to make the case to women that we have their back when we've promoted an alleged pedophile to the United States Senate.
Lindsey Graham likes to say that they can't make angry white guys fast enough for the GOP to survive on just angry white guys.
He's right.
It's a cute remark, but there's something really serious at the bottom of that.
Yeah.
Do you believe that that's what the Republican Party is in danger of becoming?
In many respects. And it's one of the efforts I undertook was I called it turning the elephant. The idea was to have the party appreciate and understand where it has been, its history, and it's more importantly, its relationship with a lot of constituencies that they've forgotten about. Our history in the black community, our history around women's suffrage, a number of things that we once stood for, we jettisoned for a strategy, you know, arguably put in place by Richard Nixon in 68, that sort of Southern strategy that focused on the white male, is played out. In fact, as national chairman, declared the Southern strategy was over because we wanted to move in a different direction. But this retreat to this space for the sake of elections, and that's what I think you're seeing play out with Moore in Alabama, is an unfortunate retreat. And I think the party is going to pay dearly down the road.
A retreat in the election of Roy Moore. And look, Michael Steele, you ran the Republican National Committee. You've sat in that office. You know what it means to fund certain campaigns and not other campaigns. Yep. Your RNC just poured $170,000 into Alabama to help Roy Moore get elected. What did you think? How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I think that's a good question. And I think it's important to understand the difference between my chairmanship and the current chairman.
Yeah, but it's your institution and you ran it. And I know that, you know, how do you feel about that?
It's not a question of how I feel. It's not a feeling thing. It's a process thing. It's a difference between having a president sitting at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, who's the titular head of the party and who runs the RNC, because that's his political arm, and not having one. I didn't have one. So I had the freedom to make those types of choices. Mm-hmm. I had candidates like Christine O'Donnell, who had to declare, "I'm not a witch," and other exciting utterances in during my cycle. But this is different. The president dictates and directs. He's directed the RNC to support his choice, and that's what they're going to do. She doesn't have a choice here. She can resign if she personally is offended by the action, but she's probably not going to do that, obviously. And so, yeah, it's unfortunate. But you know, the RNC is between a rock and a hard place here, because the chairwoman can't make an independent choice and tell mm-hmm. the president of the United States, "No, we're not funding Roy Moore."
Still, Michael Steele says that funding of Roy Moore, regardless of whose decision it is not going to a good place. Michael Steele, former chairman of the RNC. Thanks a lot.
You got it.
Hear that? Gosudarstveni gim Rossiyskoi Federatsii, the soaring Russian national anthem. You know where you won't be hearing Gosudarstveni gim Rossiyskoi Federatsii? At the 2018 Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea.
The Russian Olympic Committee is suspended with immediate effect.
No anthem, no flags, no Russian uniform, no Russian athletes representing their country. Russia's Olympic team barred from the games. That was International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach delivering the news on Tuesday. A total ban, thanks to the exposure of a massive state-backed doping program. Rebecca Ruiz is a reporter with the New York Times, and she got exclusive access to a key piece of evidence against Russia here, the detailed journals of a chemist who helped dozens of Russian athletes use banned substances. She's in Lausanne, Switzerland, home of IOC headquarters. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello, glad to be with you.
Let's talk about the punishment first, because this punishment on Russia is severe. Barring Russia from the Winter Games, no medals, no officials. Was this expected?
It's a remarkable punishment. It's a historic punishment. And this is the culmination of years of investigations and speculation and evidence coming to light.
And you have a report that's ended up here of the head of the Russian anti-doping agency in reality being the head of the Russian doping agency.
Yes. And the really remarkable thing about what we know about Russia is that certainly athletes from all nations cheat, and many have been caught in many high-profile instances. But the systematic, the pervasive quality of this, the involvement of high-up government officials, Russia's sports minister, who is now the deputy prime minister of the entire nation. He was elevated by President Putin last year in the wake of some of these revelations. He was banned for life from ever going to an Olympic Games on Tuesday.
Rebecca, Russian athletes banned, Russian government officials banned, no Russian uniforms, no Russian flags. Can Russians compete at all in South Korea?
Russians absolutely can compete in the Winter Olympics when they begin in February. What the specifics that were announced yesterday were that the Olympic Committee stressed they want to leave a pathway for clean athletes, for people who were not implicated by this massive doping program. And so to the extent that there is no evidence on a Russian athlete, no drug violation in his or her history, and he or she has been rigorously tested in the weeks leading up to the Olympics, then that athlete may petition to compete, file an application, and it will be reviewed by the International Olympic Committee. But they will be competing for themselves as individuals under the Olympic flag, meaning that when you see, say, a Russian figure skater, she or he will be identified as Olympic athlete from Russia, not for Russia. And that medal will be won, should that person win a medal, by that individual rather than attributed to the nation. If that person steps on a podium, the Russian anthem will not play. Instead, the Olympic anthem will sound.
Well, back down at the laboratory, there was also this elaborate, almost movie-level amount of scheming going on to carry out doping at the Sochi Games in Russia. Can you describe exactly what Russian operatives were up to in their lab in order to cheat?
the Russian sports ministry had led a very coordinated effort to go to the top Olympians who were due to be competing in Sochi and said, please collect your clean urine during the months when you are not using drugs and keep it in, he described, baby food jars, Coca-Cola bottles, double bag your clean urine samples, hand it over to the Russian sports ministry. It was kept in Moscow in freezers in this laboratory. That urine, that stockpiled urine, was then transported in late January 2014, weeks ahead of the Sochi Games, to Sochi, where it was kept by, according to Rodchenkov and the investigations that were commissioned by regulators, it was transported by officials and the Federal Security Service, Russia's FSB. And overnight, at the end of each day of competition, this chemist and a small team spent the hours from, say, midnight to 5 a.m. swapping out the urine samples and dumping out the tainted urine and rinsing the bottle, putting in that very same athlete's clean urine from months earlier, and then, in a very sophisticated way, balancing out certain chemical specifications that had been pre-recorded, so specific gravity, and putting in table salt or instant coffee in order to make some of these pre-recorded numbers match.
It's insane. You may not be a Russia government expert, Rebecca. Is it credible that the head of the sports ministry in Russia, who later became the deputy prime minister, could have undertaken such a large doping program without the approval of the president, Vladimir Putin?
President Putin was actively involved in preparations for the Sochi Games. And what it does come down to is projection of power. Many nations use sports as a platform to telegraph their power on the international stage. And certainly when you have investigations declaring that the FSB, that a nation's security service, was involved, what experts then say is that that level of involvement, that help, cannot be obtained without a certain level of awareness throughout the highest levels of government.
Rebecca Ruiz with the New York Times, thanks so much.
Thank you.
President Trump fulfilled one of his campaign promises today with the announcement that the United States will officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and will begin the process of moving the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
While previous presidents have made this a major campaign promise, they failed to deliver. Today, I am delivering. I've judged this course of action to be in the best interests of the United States of America and the pursuit of peace between Israel and the Palestinians.
Ambassador Dennis Ross is former Middle East peace negotiator under Presidents George H.W. Bush and President Bill Clinton, currently counselor at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Ambassador, welcome back.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
What message does this send at this moment for the President of the United States to move the U.S. interest, the U.S. Embassy, to Jerusalem?
Well, I think we still have to wait and see exactly what he is declaring that he is doing. My sense of what he's going to do is that he's going to announce that he is going to be moving it, but it will take some time. Having said that, you're dealing with the most evocative of all issues, the most emotional one from all sides' standpoint. And anytime you deal with it, you're very likely to produce a set of reactions. We've already seen in anticipation almost every Arab capital responding very negatively to this, calling on us not to go ahead and do it. So I think for the administration, especially because it wants to present a plan on Israeli-Palestinian peace, it's going to be a very heavy burden for it right now to try to convince all of the Arab leaders and the Palestinians as well that this is not a move that is designed to preempt the negotiations or the final status of the city. And the more it can demonstrate unmistakably that's the case, the more it has a chance to actually manage this.
Dennis Ross, you know, maybe it's simpler than that. I mean, you're the expert, you're the ambassador, I know. But maybe the charitable Trump observer might say he sees a negotiation coming. He's simply introducing a bargaining chip into the negotiation that he's willing to give up when a deal is struck.
That would be interesting if that were the case. There's also another possibility that he's doing this and seemingly taking a step that is very important to Israel in advance of being prepared to put positions down in the negotiations or in his plan that would be difficult for the Israelis to handle. So there may be a negotiating element here. The problem is you want to be sure you don't lose the Palestinians and Arabs in the process.
I hesitate to make things too terribly simple, Ambassador, but we are where we are with our administration. Are we witnessing the art of the deal, finally, for Israeli-Palestinian peace in two states?
I don't know. I think what the president is doing today is taking a step that I think is probably going to make it more difficult to unveil the plan without an awful lot of diplomacy between now and the time that the plan is unveiled. Had the ground been laid in advance, then you would have found it much easier, I believe, to try to manage this kind of a move, which ultimately, I think, is simply going to be reflecting a kind of statement of reality.
What do you expect the Palestinian population in the West Bank or even in Gaza to do when this news really hits home?
Well, there's no question that this is an issue that is easy to manipulate, and you're going to see Hamas and others are already calling for 3 days of rage. We'll have to see what happens. But I think because it's such a sensitive issue also for the Palestinians, that managing and trying to control the reaction is not going to be simple. So I think this is one where I hope we don't see any kind of violent reaction. You know, let's hope that this is a situation that can be managed and we don't face some of the things that we've seen in the past.
Ambassador Dennis Ross, former Mideast peace negotiator, counselor at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Ambassador, as always, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering technology solutions for businesses. From laptops and tablets to smartphones, and including tech services like setup, repair, and tech security. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Time magazine announced its Person of the Year today. The Silence Breakers, women who've come forward with stories of sexual abuse and harassment. All this week, we've been covering the recent allegations of sexual harassment, sexual assault, and bullying against the former host of this show, John Hockenberry. And we continue with that now. Kristen Meinzer was a producer on The Takeaway for 6 years. I worked with Kristen. Many of our current staff did. You heard Kristen on the air doing movies on Friday. She also produced culture segments for us. She's one of the sources named in New York Magazine. She's here with me now. Kristen, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me back, Todd.
Silence Breakers, that's you. I want to acknowledge that.
Thanks. I suppose I am, but I still have a lot of regrets that I wasn't a silence breaker when I actually worked here. It took me more than a year and a half after I left to actually speak up, and I still feel some remorse about that.
I think we all feel a lot of remorse about what's gone on around here, and I want to get to that. Before we do, we've heard parts of your story on the show this week as various guests have come through our reporting. Can you take a minute and share it with us again?
Yeah, yes. So Suki Kim lays a lot of this out in her piece in New York Magazine as well. John sent inappropriate messages to me by social media. At one point, he asked if I would go away to an island with him. He wrote me early on in my tenure here that everybody here thought I was a dominatrix, which obviously made me feel pretty bad, and I thought, what are people saying about me behind my back here? He told me I was sex obsessed on social. And that was just because I was producing movie segments that sometimes had sexual content, not because I was sex obsessed. When my now husband and I posted photos of ourselves on Facebook, he commented that he hoped that one of us had herpes. And then he forcefully kissed me in 2014. And he said it was because he was so thrilled and excited that I had booked Marion Cotillard for an interview, which is a guest that he was really hoping I would get for him. Those are some of the things he did to me. And then, of course, you know, I mean, he also just was a bully.
Yeah. Were your colleagues aware of his behavior? Your colleagues were aware that John was a bully and that John lashed out, because that was part of the culture of this studio every day.
Yeah,
the sexual behavior, the G-chats, the social media, the comments, and the kiss. Were your colleagues aware of that?
You know, I mean, what I've come to realize is he was sending those inappropriate G-chats to almost all of the young females here. It wasn't just me. But as far as him actually forcing himself on me, this week, since that piece came out from Suki Kim, one of the hosts on the show here at WNYC, but not a host on The Takeaway, he wrote on social media that he witnessed it and he expressed remorse for not doing anything at the time. And also another freelancer a young man who was freelancing with The Takeaway at the time, said he also witnessed it and didn't know what to do.
Did you feel like you could go to management with this, that you could go up the chain to HR or whatever the harassment complaint mechanism is here to get a grievance heard, to get recourse, to get protection?
No, absolutely not. And here's why. I knew that the management knew. And just to give you an idea of how much the management knew, Rupert Allman, who is the executive producer for most of my time here on the show, sent me a note this week saying, quote, "I knew he could be a bully and had problems with boundaries." So he knew. And it wasn't just Rupert, though. Farai Chidea and Celeste Headley went to station management to complain. And shortly after they did, they were gone. And I felt the message was very clear. If you complain about John too high up the ladder, then you'll be fired or you'll disappear somehow.
We got a statement from Rupert Allman that I'd like to read part of now, former executive producer of this program and during the time that you're talking about, Kristen. Rupert says, "I failed in my capacity as executive producer to grasp how egregious John Hockenberry's behavior was at the time. Yes, I knew, as did everyone else, that John was a bully to everyone. Bullying, yes. Sexual harasser, no. That I supervised a team who felt they could not tell me about his hostile and predatory behavior is on me. But it was only after reading Suki's investigation that I found out about this incident with Kristen, how he behaved with previous co-hosts and also was also known to me and to WNYC management, but it took place before I was an employee of New York Public Radio." Rupert goes on a bit, but says, "I won't be making any further comment." What do you think about your former boss's statement there?
I don't think it's enough. I mean, I think that all people in management who were involved in perpetuating and enabling John's behavior, I think all of them need to be held accountable. I think that that there was knowledge, and I don't know why nobody acted on John's behavior. I've thought about this before. Is it because John plus his boss's boss, was it because all of them had a history of dating and or marrying younger female colleagues? Is it because they wanted to maintain the status quo at WNYC, which was almost entirely white male hosts? Was it because they're of a different generation and they just saw that kind of behavior as friendly flirting in the office and saw that that was part of a newsroom culture? I'm not sure why any of them didn't act. I have no idea, but they all need to be held accountable. And I want those people in senior management who are still in the building to step down or to be fired. They should not be here anymore. And I won't feel confident that this is a safe space for all the people I love to do the great work they're doing unless some of those people are gone.
Kristen, you said on Twitter that you did not want to come on this show until WNYC management, Laura Walker, the president and CEO, came on first. Now, she has not come on this show to talk to Takeaway listeners. On Tuesday, she did go on a local program on WNYC, the Brian Lehrer Show. So listen.
These are very serious, and this behavior cannot and should not be tolerated, and it won't be tolerated. We need to do better. We need to do a lot better. I deeply regret that our culture and protocols did not work as they should, such that the full extent of the allegations are just coming to light. This alleged behavior happened on my watch, and I take responsibility.
Kristen.
All right, so it's not alleged. These things happened. And yes, WNYC does need to do better. And I am appearing on this show because Laura Walker did appear on another WNYC show, right, even though she didn't appear here. And I love all of my colleagues here at The Takeaway. I love so many people here at WNYC. And I just want them to be protected. And I want to know that going forward, this will never happen again to any of them, because all of you, Todd, are doing outstanding work. And I want everyone to feel safe to continue doing the outstanding work you've always done.
Kristen, I'm sorry this happened. I'm sorry this happened. And I thank you not only for speaking out to Suki and helping make her story happen so that we can all face what went on here and what's going on in this country, frankly, and in our culture, but that you've mustered the will and the courage to come back on the air. You and I used to sit here and do joyful movie segments, which I loved, and we used to do trivia together, and you're not here anymore. And I never wanted to see you back here having to talk about this kind of thing. I'm sorry it happened. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thanks, Todd.
After Kristen and I spoke, WNYC Radio announced two other hosts at this station, Leonard Lopate and Jonathan Schwartz, have been suspended pending a review of their conduct in the workplace. Thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.